This is Power Lunch, exclusively on Lightning Power Play via the iHeartRadio app.
I think Tony's been outstanding. Yeah, she's had crossbar post. I think in each game he's on pucks, he's stripping guys, he's in the right spots. You just wake up in the morning and put the show to box score, and he's not on the point side of things, but all the things we've been asking of him, he's been great. Killing penalties, it's Tony Cirelli hockey, and seems to elevate his game in the playoffs. He's doing that right now.
Tony Cirelli hockey.
Coop must not have realized that Cirelli got that assist added.
It's true.
After game two.
We had
because he was on the score sheet. He was 0-1-1. He had an assist.
It's a good point by you. It's actually one of the questions we've got today, amongst others. We talked about it a little bit yesterday on the show about Cirelli and his play. Is he close to breaking out? You can define breaking out however you want it to be. I think most people look at an offensive player, Dave, and they'll say breakout, meaning you've scored multiple goals or you've had multiple points. Not only in one game, but multiple games. Cirelli, we know, does a lot of things well for the Lightning, but we know he's been snake-bitten a bit by the scoring bug, and that may change, and he's getting chances. I think that's all you can ask for. So that's one of the questions we have tonight on the show. Will the crowd be the X factor tonight at Amalie Arena? 9,000 of the Lightning's closest friends, Dave, are going to be at Amalie. It's up from a couple of thousand that was previously announced. I mentioned this yesterday, and I can't wait to talk about it, amongst other things, with Brian Engblom at 12:30. And by the way, the Lightning, they're joining the City of Tampa, Hillsborough County, and local health care providers in the Together Tampa Bay Initiative, Dave, assisting in the distribution of information on, as well as access to, the COVID-19 vaccine in the Tampa Bay community. So,
can we get a translation, please?
Yes. Steve?
I think it means that you can get vaccinated if you go to the game tonight, right? Am I understanding that correctly?
I'm thinking that's what it is.
Maybe it's a little easier to understand if you can look at the words.
Vaccination
hearing
starts,
you say that, I'm like, what are you saying?
Vaccination starts at 4:30.
Okay.
Today.
You can get your vaccine.
Yes.
If you have not yet been vaccinated before the game, I think through the first period.
It says, in order to be eligible to receive a vaccine, fans must have a game ticket or one for game day parties on Ford Thunder Alley, Cigar City Tap Room, or the Pepsi Porch.
And just to be clear, you do not need a ticket to game three in order to get vaccinated. Just at this particular spot.
Yes.
There are plenty of other places, as Greg can attest, as I can attest, where you can go get vaccinated.
And
by the way, a shout out to Hillsborough County. They have done a great job with that. I mean, we both had very seamless experiences.
I've got to be honest with you.
You
know, from the different guests we've had on who aren't in this state, I think Florida's done a pretty good job of getting the vaccine out. As I told you before, Dave, I think if you want a vaccine, you can get one. So, I mean, I think big picture, it's been a smoother rollout, I think, here than in some other places. Regardless, if you need a vaccine, you can get one. And tonight, the Lightning teaming up with their partners here to give you that opportunity. So I think that's all positive. What I was going to say, Dave, in terms of the crowd, the Lightning increasing it to 9,000 tonight, I am very intrigued to see how the crowd helps the Lightning. Now, you could say it hurts them because sometimes you get a little jacked up a little too much, and maybe you're running around and doing things you typically don't do. But this is the first time we will see a crowd for a playoff game on home ice after the Stanley Cup playoffs, especially. And I think this is just one of those things. I don't know how to quantify it. And I'm really curious to see how big of a lift they get. Because, Dave, as you know, a lot of times those first 10 minutes of a game, particularly that first game in front of your home building, your home barn, I mean, you dictate play. I mean, you have the other team on their toes, and for a team like Florida who is down 0-2, that could be a dicey situation if the Lightning come out flying and really are dictating play, and they're able to get a couple of goals past Chris Drieger, by the way, who is going to be in net.
which we kind of alluded to yesterday in our conversation, that we wouldn't have been surprised if Drieger would be the starter in game three. I think there is a line, and may need to be a fine line, but there is a line that the players need to be aware of, and this is an experienced group. Although their experience in winning the Stanley Cup came with no fans in the building. So this is different than anything they experienced last year. But using the energy of the home crowd when you were the home team in a productive way and not in a counterproductive way. And I'm pretty sure you remember the series, Greg, when the Lightning and Penguins met in 2011. I remember at the start of Game 3, which was the first home game the Lightning had in that series, and they had split the first two. The Lightning had won Game 2 in Pittsburgh. So that series was 1-1 coming back to Tampa. And most, not all, but most of the Lightning roster that year was, relatively speaking, inexperienced in the playoffs.
Was that Stamkos' first taste?
Yes.
Not first taste, but that was just...
Yeah, no, it was. Hedman, same thing. Yeah. And the guy I'm going to talk about is Steve Downey, but, I mean, he was new to all of this. And, you know, they brought in some guys like Dominic Moore. I think had a little playoff experience previously. He had been in Pittsburgh. Sean Bergenheim. Yeah, but the guys like St. Louis and Le Cavalier, certainly. I mean, they'd won a cup.
Sure.
But I remember right at the beginning of that game, the Lightning came out. The crowd was going crazy. There was a ton of energy. And Ben Lovejoy, who was a defenseman for the Penguins on that team, got the puck behind the Pittsburgh net, and Downey absolutely obliterated him. It was a huge hit. Huge hit. And the crowd went crazy, but Lovejoy got the puck away before he got hit. He rimmed it around the boards, and the Penguins ended up scoring. Now, it wasn't just due to the Downey hit.
Yeah, right.
But it's almost like the Lightning were so amped up to feed off that energy and to come out and set the tone, big hits. Like, they got the big hit, but they blew the coverage. And the Penguins ended up winning both games 3 and 4 at Amalie Arena. They were both close games. James Neal scored in double overtime in game 4. But I remember coming out of those two games thinking the Penguins look like a team that knew how to handle that, and the Lightning were learning. They were learning on the fly. And the Lightning, of course, ultimately prevailed in that series. But I'm using that Downey play as an example of
sure.
how the energy of the crowd can be counterproductive. Look, if he had delivered a hit like that and the Lightning had been tight with their coverage after the puck left the zone, fine. But you can get caught up in the emotion of it, and you can't forget the bread and butter of the details of the game, because the opponent won't. The opponent's like,
it's
what?
A good point.
We just got a 3-on-2 out of this?
It's
we'll take the
point.
Hit.
Yeah,
and we got a scoring chance out of this.
And you're right, because the hit by Downey on itself was probably fine. It's what happened.
Yeah, I don't think there was a penalty on it.
No.
But it was almost like everyone got mesmerized by the hit and forgot about the players who were skating down the ice about to score a goal.
What's always interesting, too, and I think it's one thing that we can take away a little bit, Dave, from the first two games, is that I think even the star players are a bit physical for the Lightning. Kucherov, I think, is looking for contact. Stamkos, I think, has been pretty physical. I mean, those are guys that, you know, in the regular season, they're going to be somewhat physical, but it always amazes me when playoff hockey arises is even your star players are going to get involved in the fight, so to speak. And I do think there is no question there is going to be a huge amount of electricity to start. Now,
and you know, another example, and this was a very positive example, and you were with the Lightning, you know, working, covering the team at that point, Greg, 2015, Stanley Cup Final, Game 1, Period 1. I mean, the Lightning completely dominated the 20 minutes. That might have been their most dominant period in that entire playoff run. That was the one where Killorn scored batting the puck out of the air.
Yes.
But they could have scored more than one. They ended up losing Game 1 2-1 because they couldn't maintain it. But that is an example of using the energy of the crowd in a very productive way. And Corey Crawford, who had a really great year that you're in the playoffs after the first round, which we talked about earlier this week, where he got pulled. But once he came back in, he had a phenomenal playoff year. He had a great Stanley Cup final, too. And that first period of game one probably goes right to the top of the list. He was fantastic for Chicago to keep that game 1-0. But the Lightning were in control of their like, they fed off the crowd's energy in a productive way in that first period.
And what's going to be interesting, too, is I think you bring up a really valid point, is that if the Lightning can get a lead, can they get a two-goal lead? Can they build on that momentum? You come out and you're flying and you get that first goal. As you said, Dave, how many times have we seen that's the only goal you get during that initial surge? Then the other team kind of gathers themselves, and now it becomes an even game, and they even start to push back. This is where I think Driedger and Nett's going to be interesting. We talked about the lack of playoff experience. He's never experienced something like this. This is the first time he is going on the road in this type of environment in front of fans who are just dying to see this Lightning team in a playoff game, even if it's only 9,000. So that atmosphere, I think, look, I don't know Driedger. Mentally, you've got to think he's tough. You're an NHL goaltender.
Yeah,
I think
and
you
he's not 21, 22.
He's
either.
Not. I mean, he's not.
Lacking in postseason experience, but not lacking in professional experience.
That is correct.
27.
But I am curious to see if the Lightning can get one, does an Avalanche start to come? Can they get two? Can they get three? If they get one, what happens to the surge by the Panthers? And you know what? The other side of this could be, you know, maybe the Panthers are able to take advantage of Tampa Bay's aggressiveness. And what if they get a 1-0 lead and all of a sudden the crowd is toned down a bit? I think that's exactly what the Panthers want. In fact, I think you can make the argument, Dave, for me, the way I'm looking at this, and I want your opinion, obviously, in our audience at Bolts Radio. I think it is more important for the Panthers to play with a lead and to score first tonight than it is the Tampa Bay Lightning. Because I think the Lightning, if they're not playing well, they're going to get some momentum from the crowd regardless. There will be those initial surges. The crowd will get Tampa Bay going if they see them struggling just a bit. The Panthers are going to have to, they can use the crowd to their advantage. But it's going to, they need to score first. I'm just going to lay it out there right now. You're down 0-2. You need to score first to take the crowd out of the game and get yourself settled. I think it's a must-win game for the Florida Panthers. I gave you my reasons yesterday about why I don't think this team can win 4 or 5 against the Lightning. Well, they need to start doing it if they want to tonight. And I think you need to play with the lead. I think you need to score first and take this crowd out of it, because I think it's just going to be crazy at Amalie Arena. I could be wrong. I don't think I am.
It's hard to predict exactly how a game will go. Now, it's not hard to predict what the atmosphere will be like. The atmosphere will be electric, and there will be a lot of energy in the crowd. But you mentioned an Avalanche, and before we came on the air today, Greg, I was actually observing some of the highlights from the Avalanche game last night against the St. Louis Blues. And I'm going to talk about McKinnon in a second here,
because
he has just gotten off to an incredible start. He had a hat trick last night. But it wasn't quite like this situation, because it was 1-0 Colorado in the series and not 2-0, where, you know, the team that's down absolutely has to win or else it's going to be, you know, down 0-3 and facing elimination. But the Avalanche came out, they scored in the opening shift. This is a home game for Colorado. They scored on the opening shift following a big hit. There was a big hit on Ryan O'Reilly, the former Avalanche, behind the St. Louis net. Jonas Donskoi scored on a tip. And then McKinnon scored at the end of the first period to make it 2-0. And then the Avs got another goal on the power play. Their goals 2 and 3 were both power play goals. In the second period, they're up 3-0. And you're like, all right, well, this is kind of following the script. The Avs came out, the home crowd gave them energy. They scored in the opening shift. Like, to your point, can they add to it? Yes, they did. It wasn't just 1-0. It was 3-0. The Blues chipped one in near the end of the second. So it's 3-1 going into the third. And then the game got crazy in the third period. Nazem Kadri takes a match penalty on a hit that he's probably going to get supplemental discipline for. And that changes the complexion of the game. The Blues scored 1 on the major, so now it's 3-2. McKinnon makes it 4-2. with like 4.5 minutes left, but the Blues score in the very next shift. So now it's 4-3. Final score was 6-3. So you're like, all right, the Avalanche won easily. Well, not exactly. They scored two empty netters. They were up 3-0, but that 3-0 lead became 3-2. And then they were up 4-3 with, you know, under a couple of minutes left. And in the third period, the Blues outshot the Avalanche by more than 2-1. So that game had a lot of different wrinkles to it. Now you're going to say, maybe make the argument that had Kadri not committed that penalty, maybe the Avs kind of just put it on cruise control and there's no drama in the third period. But you just never know how a game is going to turn, because the Avalanche followed the exact script that you just laid out, right? They scored early. They built a multi-goal lead. They had control of the game. And yet, it I don't want to say it almost slipped away. They were never tied after that. But things got interesting for sure as the game progressed.
You mentioned Kadri, and that was also one of the questions that we can discuss outside of the Lightning game tonight, and that would be, does he deserve a suspension for his hit? And before you say absolutely, understand who we're dealing with here. And
repeat offender.
Yeah, I mean, he's been there, done that.
He's not going in the same as Sam Bennett. Sam Bennett had never been suspended before.
I was thinking more of Tom Wilson, but
Tom Wilson has been suspended before.
Well, you know, but I mean, I'm just saying, like, the we saw Wilson hit, and obviously it's a little bit different than the one we saw with Kadri and Falk there. But the reality is, these hits to the head. The funny thing is about Kadri, it's not funny. It wasn't late. It was high, at least how I saw it.
And it was on the side. I almost feel, Greg, that, and look, there are some head-on hits, no pun intended, where the guy receiving the hit to the head does sustain a fairly significant injury. But I almost feel like when the head is whiplash side to side, those are the ones that seem to have more lasting impact in terms of a guy battling these symptoms. And I know you remember Crosby's that concussion in the Winter Classic from David Steckel. That was not a head-on hit. That was a
Dave,
side
all Pittsburgh
hit.
Remembers that.
Yeah,
all
but the hit itself was a side hit. Like, well, the head was knocked left to right, wasn't it?
No, and you know, the one that even sticks out more was the Matt Cook hit. And that was to
Savard? Mark Savard?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if you take a look at how Cook hit him, it was from the side.
That's what I'm saying.
Well, yeah, that's what I mean. Yeah. Those are worse.
Yeah.
I think.
And that was what happened to Falk last night.
Yeah, and you know, listen, I have maintained, and Dave, you know, I'm going to give these opinions, and I hate to do a broad brush on these things, but it takes the decision-making out of the people who have shown a inconsistency when it comes to penalties like this. And I understand Kadri's a repeat offender, and chances are he will be suspended because he's done this in the playoffs before, in addition to the regular season. By the way, he's a pretty good player. And yes, he hurts his team when he does this.
Yeah, but I think he does this certainly in Toronto. He had his fingerprints all over some of those collapses, or at least losses by the Maple Leafs, by taking penalties.
And so I think, you know, clearly he plays with a certain aggression, and that's fine. What's not fine is that he continues to do it. And for a league that is trying to, again, crack down on hits to the head, and I think really trying to educate the players on what they can and can't do, because you can say all you want, there is a disconnect between the players and what the league wants when it comes to being physical and what's a legitimate hit and what is not. I do think there is, and some of it, Dave, as you had mentioned, there's some gray area there that if a guy turns at the last minute, that maybe the guy who delivered the hit shouldn't be suspended because the guy that got hit was put in a tough position by himself. I understand that. But I've given the league too many years of trying to figure this out consistently on their own. And so what I'm going to do is take it out of their hands and say, if you hit a guy in the head, like we saw last night, maybe like we saw with Tom Wilson, whether you agree with it or not, because you have shown no ability to be consistently accurate with this type of penalty, there is going to be an automatic suspension. If you are a repeat offender, maybe you tack on an extra 5 games. So for a guy like Kadri, who's done this in the playoffs in the regular season, and you can sit there and say, look, he's done this 5 times. He's been suspended 5 times. You know what you do? You tack on for each time you do it 5 games. And if you don't like it, then stop doing it, because that's a cheap hit. Falk's lucky that he was able to get up and walk or skate. That's a dangerous hit.
That was not a situation like I've talked about. You know, you're going in for a hit, and the hit is going to end up being delivered in the chest. Kind of like Gudas's hit on Blake Coleman in game two. That was a perfectly fine check.
It was.
And he hit him right in his Lightning logo. But what if the guy ducks down at the last second and then it becomes a hit to the head? That's where I have said, like, sometimes there's a gray area. The one last night with Falk and Kadri, there was no gray area.
None.
Like, Falk did not change the position of his head. In fact, it almost looked like Kadri tried to, like, nudge himself up to hit him higher.
I mean, what
and we'll
is
see
that?
We'll see what the league has to say
what
about
it. What is that? With these guys, I mean, honestly, I look, I know I haven't played. I understand that, but the league has clearly made it a point to avoid hits like that. I mean, you have to know that you have been targeted before.
I will ask you to save your outrage until the league makes its ruling, and maybe you'll be in complete agreement.
I don't think I'll ever be in complete agreement.
You probably aren't.
But, you know,
I just wanted to quickly talk about McKinnon, and then we'll get back to Panthers Lightning, because there is some developing news of interest on the Panthers side here. Nathan McKinnon. So, I mean, this guy can shoot the puck like very few others. I don't want to say like nobody, because there are some great shooters in this league. But like Ovechkin and Stamkos can hammer one-timers off slap shots, and McKinnon can do that too. McKinnon's wrist shot, though, is incredible. And I mentioned the goal he scored in game one, which broke a tie 30 seconds into the third period. The Avs ended up going on to win 4-1. Like, he gets the puck at the bottom of the right faceoff circle. Goalie is set. I mean, McKinnon's open. Goalie is set. Zip! Top of the net. I mean, like, put it in a spot where I don't know if there's a goalie today that can make that save, particularly if they're a butterfly goalie, which most goalies are. That's an amazing shot. But what I noticed in the game last night, watching the highlights, McKinnon had 4 points.
Yeah.
He had an empty netter. In fact, 2 of his 5 goals this year have been empty netters. So he's gotten his candy as well, but he's earned everything else. Everything else he has completely earned, not scoring into an open net. So the 3 other points that he had last night, 2 goals and an assist, were all similar. 2 were on the power play, 1 was even strength. On the power play, he's standing at the center point, and on the non-power play goal, I think he was kind of top of the left circle, but fairly far from the goal. And what he was able to do on all 3 of those was get his shot through. Look, if you watch the replay, there's just a massive humanity between McKinnon and the net. And this guy finds a way to get, and it's not just like slow pitch softball. I mean, he is getting the puck with some zip on it to the top of the net. Now, one of them, Donskoy, tipped, but Donskoy's the last guy. Like, it got through everybody else, and then Donskoy's standing in front of Binnington and tips it in. The other two, it zipped past like 5 players and the goalie into the net. Now, how often do we talk about like how hard it is to get shots through? That's another skill McKinnon has. And like Peter McNabb on the broadcast was saying, like, watch McKinnon, his head is up. He holds it. His head is up. He's looking at where he wants to put it. He's finding that little opening, and he's getting it through. That, in this day and age, is amazing. It's amazing to score goals like that from just inside the blue line with 3 defenders and a couple of your own guys who don't want to block it, but sometimes it hits them, standing between you and the goalie. That's amazing.
You know,
he's having an amazing playoff so far, just 2 games in.
You almost have to today in today's NHL with the way players block shots and how big and athletic the goaltenders are. You almost need to adjust and adapt and be that accurate with your shot if you want to be considered an elite sniper. I mean, he's a sniper. Matthews is a sniper. We've seen Stamkos and Ovechkin. I even think you can make the argument Kucherov has one of the best wrist shots in the game.
Yeah.
We just don't see it enough because he's such a good playmaker. But those guys, Dave, because of the way the game has been played today and really the last 5-10 years with systems and blocking shots, you really do need to have pinpoint accuracy in addition to having a hard wrister. And I think you're right. I mean, I think McKinnon, You know, a lot of people, Dave, will not only say he's got the best shot, but also he may be next to McKinnon or McDavid and even Braden Point, maybe the fastest guy in the league. I mean, he's a dynamic guy. And honestly, Colorado is one of those teams. The talk about them being an up-and-coming team is nice, but now they've got to start doing something in the playoffs and get to that Stanley Cup final and win it with that core group intact. McKinnon certainly is somebody that can lead the way and get it done, but it's been fun watching him for sure.
I've been really impressed watching the Avs.
They've been good.
I mentioned, you know, 50 shots in the first game, and they had control of that game last night before the match penalty on Kadri. So we have Brian coming up, but the news on the Panther side, surprisingly, Keith Yandel was skating with the extras. Keith Yandel, now this streak is not going to be affected if he does not play in the playoffs because it is a regular season streak. 923 consecutive regular season games that Yandel has played, and he's never missed a playoff game. And if you remember, at the very start of the year, Greg, there was talk that Quenneville might have scratched Yandel, and maybe he would have had the Dallas Stars not had a COVID outbreak, because those early games, the Panthers were supposed to open against the Stars, and then the Stars had to postpone the first two of a number of games that got postponed. And so the Panthers didn't start when they were supposed to start. Like, the Lightning played the first two games against Chicago. The Panthers started later when Chicago left Tampa and went to Sunrise. And by then, Yandel was back in the mix. But, like, that we were talking about, are you surprised that, you know, Driedger started game two? And I was like, well, I'm not shocked that he started game two. He played a lot during the regular season. And it's not shocking that he's now starting game three because, you know, from what he saw in game two, he didn't see a lot of activity, but he played pretty well. The Yandel move, if that is in fact going to be the case tonight, that Keith Yandel is a healthy scratch, and presumably Strawman would be the guy coming in, you'd be swapping a lefty for a righty. But Strawman was not skating with the scratches. Maybe that was just some kind of smoke and mirrors thing. But if that is in fact the case, that would be very surprising to me. Yandel is their main, with Ekblad out, Yandel is their one defenseman on their top power play unit. And he's been a regular. And did he have a terrible game too? I mean, he had the turnover on the Gord empty netter, but
I mean, he's a minus one. He's got two assists. I'd have to go back and look every time
assists. Well, one was on the power play.
Yeah.
I think the other was on the Verhaeghe goal.
Well, he's at 18. One. I mean, look, his specialty, Dave, is power play.
That's what I'm saying. So, like,
but I'm wondering,
Are you going to put Uyghur then on that unit? Like, that's really interesting.
But I'm wondering if
that
this
is in fact going to be the case.
And I'm just generalizing here because, again, I'd have to go back and watch Yandel specifically. But knowing what we know about his skill set, are we looking at this? Is Quenneville going more defense at the expense of offense on his back end? Because maybe he's looking
Strawman
at
is a very steady, as we know, defenseman. Very steady defensive defenseman. But he has fallen down the depth chart there.
Well, he has. But he's also experienced, and he also knows these Lightning players.
Nobody on the Panthers has more playoff experience than Anton Strawman.
I've told you, this is a must-win. In my opinion, Dave, this is a must-win game for the Panthers. I'm just curious, based off of the decision, and I don't know if we can get Quenneville to address this. But did he already speak? I think he already spoke. But I'm curious, is he looking at this and saying, playing at home, the Lightning are, there's 9,000 fans, they're going to be jacked, ready to go, they're going to come at us, there's going to be a big push. Does Strawman, look, he's not the savior, he's not the same player he was a couple of years ago, let alone when he was at his peak in 2016 with the Tampa Bay Lightning before he broke his leg. But are we looking at this and saying, Quenneville wants a little more defense than offense tonight, and he's willing to sacrifice that a bit on the back end with Strawman coming in there, even if it's a little bit of a subtle change? I don't know. Yeah. I'm trying to rationalize a move.
Well, we'll
like
ask
that.
Brian about it.
We will. He's up next. Brian Engblom.
Maybe he saw something from Yandel that we didn't.
I want to also ask him what the crowd was like and how jacked up is he as an announcer to do a game like us tonight at Amalie Arena. It's going to be a lot of fun. He is Dave Mishkin. I am Greg Linnelli. Don't forget, the game's at 6:30 tonight. We are going to be the airwaves on Lightning Power Play starting at 5:30 with Brian Burns, Kaylee Chelios, and Bobby the Chief Taylor. Then I'll have the pregame at 6, and then Dave and the Hall of Famer Phil Esposito at 6:30. And then we have you covered afterwards with The Last Call. He is Dave Mishkin. I am Greg Linnelli. Steve Ersnick producing. Brian Engblom up next on Lightning Power Play.
This is Power Lunch, exclusively on Lightning Power Play on the iHeartRadio app.
Game 3 tonight at Amalie Arena. It should be rocking. Glad you're with us here for Power Lunch on Lightning Power Play. I am Greg Linnelli, along with Dave Mishkin, Steve Ersnick's producing. Hit us up on Twitter, at Bolts Radio. Joining us right now, you see him on the TV broadcast, former NHL player, outstanding analyst, our good friend. That would be Brian Engblom. Brian, great to be with you again. And, you know, I think there are many storylines tonight, but for me, how vocal the crowd is and how the Lightning are going to feed off that energy might be the biggest one for me. There's just going to be a lot of pent-up excitement that we haven't seen in quite some time.
Yeah, that's true. I think every player and both coaches remarked on the crowds in Florida, and I'm sure that the Lightning fans will take that as a challenge, and rightfully so. It's great. Look, it's the entertainment business. And the players feed off the emotion, both the home team and the road team. It's great. It changes how you feel out there. So I expect it to be rowdy and raucous as usual, and I'm looking forward to it too.
Brian, we don't know if this is smoke and mirrors from the Panthers, but Keith Yandle was skating with the extras after their skate this morning, and he is the holder of a very long consecutive games played streak in the regular season, 923 games. He's never missed a playoff game. If in fact he is scratched tonight, like, how surprised are you that he would not be playing? And have you seen anything from him specifically in the first two games that might lead Quenneville to making this switch?
No, and it surprises me a little bit because he's out there on their power play a lot too. And he's their quarterback at the top, like Hedman is for the Lightning. As far as the streak goes, there was a lot of talk during the course of the season. I think Joel Quenneville and the management handled it well. It's a really tough spot, actually, for them to be in. They don't want to be that guy or that organization that takes it away. It's an impressive record. And, you know, chances are it's never going to be touched again. I mean, he's got a chance maybe to go in front of Doug Jarvis for the tops, all time. And I wouldn't know what to do with that either. He has slowed down a bit for sure. He's a really good puck handler. He understands the game. The foot speed sometimes gets him in a little bit of trouble. So that's usually what happens when you get a little long in the tooth playing defense. I don't know who they plan to put in if he comes out. They did dress seven the other day. Strahlman came in, but they have kind of said the same thing about Strahlman, talking to some people this morning, that he has just slowed down a bit, so he's not in the lineup on a regular basis either. So it'll be interesting to see what they do and how it affects their power play up top.
Yeah, it looks like Strahlman might be that guy who replaces him. We'll see. As you mentioned, they went seven last time, and we'll see who fills in if they go that route. Elliot Friedman, by the way, just a quick note on Yandle. He said he checked with the NHL. If Yandle does not play tonight, it will not end his consecutive game streak of 922. So that's just more of a technical thing that Friedman got from the league. Brian, the games have been competitive through two games, but the Lightning have found ways to win both of them. I think there are several reasons for that, but I'm wondering, in your opinion, is the biggest reason maybe Tampa Bay star players just being a bit better than the Panthers?
Yeah, I think, well, both games were very different. We had all the goals scored in game one. It was crazy intense, crazy fast, and vicious hitting. Over the top, and that ended up with a lot more penalties, and they could have called a lot more penalties in game one and in game two for that matter. But that's another topic we can talk about. But the second game was much tighter to the vest. And I think we saw a Lightning team that we saw probably 10 or 12 times through the playoffs last year, winning the cup, where they really tighten it down. It was a totally different feeling game. Yes, there was still pace to the game. Yes, there was still hitting. It was a little less frenetic. There was a little bit more control after the whistles than there had been in game one. And I expect that to that discipline to go up another notch in this game three here tonight, because power plays obviously have been effective in the series, especially for the Lightning. So I think the scrums after the fact are what's going to get toned down. I think especially for Florida, I think Quenneville is going to say, hey, guys, we can't afford that. So pick your spots for sure, and we can't have that extra stuff. Hit guys hard, run them, do whatever, but make sure that that extra stuff doesn't happen, because, you know, we can't afford this. So I think it was a flavor of two different games. And the Lightning have the answer for both types of games. You want to be wide open. And we've seen that a lot between these two teams over the course of regular seasons over the last 3, 4, 5 years. It gets crazy even in November when they play Florida. You know, it gets crazy back and forth and some great skill. And then it tones back down. But I thought the Lightning had really good control of this game. Look, Florida's got some serious guys who can score, and a lot of them. And so you're not going to control every minute of every game and not have the puck as much as you want sometimes. Cooper made mention of that. He said, hey, maybe we'd like to have the puck a little more. But the bottom line is we won two games, and that's what we set out to do.
Brian, we saw enough of the Panthers during the regular season to know and understand how dangerous they can be off the rush and in transition. I thought one area of the Lightning's game in game two that was terrific was that third forward applying back pressure. And I remember specifically in the third period, Palat and Gord made plays. One of them was on Barkov for sure, where they got in on him and basically took the puck away from him in the neutral zone, helping out the two defensemen. How important is that going to be moving forward in this series for the Lightning to try and, if not slow down the Panthers, at least make them less dangerous in transition when they enter the Lightning's end?
They are fantastic at transition game and stretching the ice, making long passes and trying to get the Lightning D to back off. They use that card a lot in game one. They would send one forward out to the far blue line, pushing guys like McDonough back because you can't just leave a guy in behind you. So they stretch them out a lot. The neutral zone for me, right from the very beginning before the series started, the neutral zone was the key to the entire series. Yeah, you have to play hard in front of your net, all that kind of stuff. But for me, because of the way they play, and the Lightning can get into a run-and-gun game pretty quick there, but we've also seen them get shut down in the neutral zone, right? 2 years ago against Columbus was the best example. Neutral zone is really important. And it got loose in the first game, for sure. They still won the game, but they knew they had to make some changes. And I remember Ryan McDonough saying, our F3, that high forward that you just talked about, Dave, that's the key. You can't lose all three guys. You can't get so puck-focused that all three are stuck, because as soon as they touch the puck, they have at least one guy flying the zone and the other two guys come up high and you get those outnumbered attacks. They love to do that. It gave me the creeps. It reminded me of signs of the Edmonton Oilers way back in the day when they had to play against Gretzky and Messier and those guys. That's what they would do. The instant that one of their guys was going to touch the puck, you'd have two guys flying the zone. And it really gives you the creeps as a defenseman, like, yeah, I got to get back. And if you're not paying attention, I mean, you're in deep trouble. So, yes, you need that third guy high. That guy has to be reading what he's looking at there. And also, so does the offside defenseman. That offside defenseman definitely has to be looking away from the play, not get fixated, and be backing up with those guys. All those things are really important, or you're going to be in trouble against Florida.
Brian Engbaum joins us here on Power Lunch on Lightning Power Play. We're getting you set for Game 3 tonight between the Lightning and Panthers. Brian, are the Lightning right now, and until Barkley Goodrow gets back, more of a three-line team compared to last year? It's not a knock on them, and it's only two games, but it feels like that's how it's playing out right now.
I agree with you. Yeah, it's a very good point. I thought fourth line for fourth line in Game 1, excuse me, for sure, Florida's fourth line outplayed the Lightning's. No doubt in my mind about it. That fourth line, as a matter of fact, Achari was in the middle in that first game, and it was Marchment, Lomberg, and Achari. And I thought they did exactly what they're supposed to do. All the face washing and the odd punch in the head and the wrestling. It was WWF there in some stages after whistles by both teams, members of both teams. I thought they get under the skin. Lomberg in particular seems to have a vendetta against Mikhail Sergachev in particular. And to be honest with you, I thought Lomberg got Sergey off his game. I didn't think Sergey was very effective at all. And a matter of fact, in game two, I made the comment, Sergey, either focus or fight. Make up your mind, because he's got you right now. He's got you off your game. Now, Sergachev did a better job in game two in that. And I'm fine. If you want to walk away, then don't even look at him. Take the hit. And there were some late hits by Lomberg, but Sergey was rattled. He was off his game. He was bitching at the refs and all kinds of stuff. He just never got into his real game. I credit Lomberg for that. He's doing exactly what he's getting paid to do. Now, they had to make adjustments. Achari had to move up because of the Bennett suspension. I think they lost something there. So with Bennett back in, I would be shocked if Achari, Lomberg, and Marchment don't play back together again. Maybe they'll go with 7D. I don't know. It's possible, in which case somebody's got to come out. But I thought they were very effective in the Lightning fourth line. When they went down to, you know, only 11 forwards, Maroon played more. Johnny got spotted in. People were playing with different combinations, and Maroon had a chance to get in. I didn't even notice Maroon in game one. He tried to get involved later in the game, particularly with Lomberg, but he wasn't able to get there. And I kept thinking, come on, come on, grab the guy, grab the guy. By the end of game one, I wanted to punch Lomberg in the mouth about four times.
We have discussed before the series and as the series got underway, this, I'll call it an interesting move by the Lightning to reunite McDonough and Chernak and the reasons why they did that, and then what that meant for Savard. And Savard and Sergachev did not play a lot during the tail end of the regular season. They played a little, but it did seem like they had a much better game two than game one as a pair, and maybe some of that is tied to what you were talking about on the Sergachev side. But what did you see from that pair beyond just Sergachev? Sergachev and Savard as a pair in game two that allowed them to be more effective than they were in game one?
Well, familiarity would certainly help. I loved it when I saw before the practices leading into the series where Coop had put Chernak back with McDonough. I went, oh, okay. Ruta with Hedman, they play really well together. But McDonough and Chernak, you knew he was going to match him up against Barkov whenever he can. And those two are so familiar. Savard played well with McDonough. The thing I've noticed, and I started thinking about this before the series, Savard, the way he played in Columbus and the way they played in Columbus, I started thinking the Lightning didn't have that much trouble getting over the blue line, particularly when Savard was out there. Savard and his partners would back in and protect the house, and their forwards would come back to the middle. They'd give you the outside. Savard with McDonough trying to play against Barkov, you don't let Barkov in over the blue line easily. You have to defend the blue line hard. Chernak and McDonough can do that, and they like to do it. They can stand up. What I come to understand with Savard, he's uncomfortable with standing up at the red line the way the Lightning have for the last couple of seasons. He doesn't like it. He has that feeling of, somebody's getting behind me. These guys are coming too fast. I got to back up. So you can't hold the blue line if one guy is at the blue line and the other guy is back 10 or 12 feet. So that's why I think they took Savard away from McDonough and they put him with Sergey. So having said all that, familiarity with Sergey. They play a little bit differently. Savard is trying to hold up, but he's playing his game. Sergachev's got good speed to come over and support and whatever else. But I think sort of Savard played himself into that spot with Sergey. And I think he's been okay all the way along. I think there's a chance to get better, but I still don't think he's comfortable. I just think he's really having a tough time transitioning from the way they played in Columbus to the style that the Lightning play, plus the speed with which the Lightning play in transition. So he's getting better. I think there's still more room for improvement there. And he's got it, quite frankly, he's got to continue to improve. Or you might see Shen come in.
Brian Engbaum joins us here on Power Lunch on Lightning Power Play. Brian, is this a must-win game for the Panthers. I can't see them beating the Lightning 4 out of the next 5 games, but if they're going to, it would seem like tonight is a game they absolutely need.
Yeah, you would think. There are so few situations in history where teams have ever come back from 3 games down. I mean, there's a handful. So, I mean, the logic of it says you get down 3 games, you're in trouble. So you really have to empty the tank. So I think in these situations, you often see more momentum and more push in a game 3 than you do in a game 4 when you're down 0-3. That may sound funny, but I think that feeling of, oh my goodness, we're done, you know, when you're 0-3, you try early on and then it just kind of, you know, you give the effort, but you just have that sinking feeling like we're just not good enough. So I think a game 3 like this, absolutely, they're going to be geared up. Florida's going to come and push, you know, as hard as they can early on. I just think it's going to be physical. I think there will be less, they'll play more whistle to whistle, and they'll have to. There'll still be the intimidation. There'll still be the yakking at each other and all that other stuff. But they're going to need some goals early on. So I think you're going to see the big boys come out there and play a ton early, Huberdeau and Barkov. And Huberdeau is going to be better with Bennett back in the lineup. I don't think there's any doubt about that. I didn't think he was quite as good in game 2. He had played with Wennberg a ton during the year, apparently, but he was better with Bennett, and Bennett is back in tonight. So I think those two guys, 16 and 11, are the ones you're going to have to keep your eye on.
Brian, we have talked extensively on our program here about Anthony Cirelli's scoring slump. And we've talked about how it almost seems like when he plays Anthony Cirelli type hockey, which is like a dog with a bone on the puck and winning puck battles, that the rest of his game falls into place. And he's come close, certainly, both at the end of the regular season and at the start of this series, to breaking his goal drought. Are you liking what you're seeing from him beyond the close calls offensively in terms of the other parts of his game? Being hard on pucks, being in the opposition's face, having the puck and not letting the other team getting it away from him, not let the other team get it away from him, which has been kind of a staple of his game since he joined the Lightning at the NHL level.
I think we all love Anthony Cirelli the way he plays. He brings so much to the team, and yes, I do see that. But I see about a half notch off, Dave, and that's confidence, lack of it. What is he at, 30 games now without a goal? That's a lot. And when he's had his chances, there's some doubt there. So just that half notch up, yes. Is he still hounding the puck? Yes. Is he still smart as heck? Yes. He's beyond his years and has been since his first year in the league. He knows the game and where he's supposed to be. But when he does turn those pucks over and he gets those chances, I see that little second guess, that little hesitation where he, instead of driving all the way and being decisive and shooting or making the move or whatever it is, there's just that second of hesitation of what am I going to do and is it going to go in, sort of thing. So do I notice a difference? Yes. I hope one goes in off his backside and relieves a little pressure. And then I think, you know, when the dam breaks, and I'm sure it will, he works way too hard, creates too much, and plays with guys who are too skilled for this to go on much longer. I mean, he is overdue. And when he does, I think things will certainly change for him. But he'll never stop working. He's not one of those guys where if you lose him on the scoring edge for a while and he's not on the point sheet, that, you know, you can't play him as much because he's just sulking and he's just not performing. You don't have to do that with Anthony Cirelli because he's still giving you all the other stuff. So those are the guys that you really root for. It's kind of like Yanni Gourde last year, right? During the regular season, Yanni couldn't score for anything. And then look what he did in the playoffs. You know, he really came around. So I think for Cirelli, his time is coming really quickly.
Brian Engblom joining us here on Power Lunch on Lightning Power Play. Brian, this question comes from a listener, and they want to ask you, do you see hope in Tyler Johnson's game and see it coming around? Or are we looking at him being scratched for Stevens or Joseph soon?
Good question. I don't see the scratch thing happening. Tyler's become a different player for sure. And we talk about, you know, the confidence level just a moment ago with Cirelli. I think you can amplify that for Tyler. I think he's lost an edge when it comes to his offensive confidence. I don't think there's any dispute on that. But Tyler's a very intelligent player. He's a very good two-way player. When the series opened, and again, the adjustments that Cooper made, I talked about McDonough and Chernak and the matchup thing. When I saw him put him at fourth line center, first thing I did was look at the fourth line of Florida, Achari, Lomberg, and Marchment. Achari is a pretty damn good fourth line center. He, you know, came from the Boston Bruins, well-trained. And I thought, huh, Tyler against Achari. That's some pretty good stuff. That's smart. I like that combo, as well as moving Colton, you know, with Gord and Coleman. I like that. It just made sense. Colton's great young player, but he doesn't have experience, and you have to be careful there. Center ice position's important. So all those things, the logic of it looked really smart. So I think there certainly is some, you know, some thought process beyond, you know, Tyler just not scoring and sort of people looking at it as just a total demotion going to the fourth line. I don't see it that way. I don't see him being scratched out of the lineup. No, I think he's too valuable. And I think he's one of those guys, again, if he can get a goal or two and get some confidence back and some spring in his step offensively, just that, you know, that second or two that we just talked about with Cirelli, same thing can happen with Tyler. I mean, he's got history on his side when it comes to his performances in the playoffs.
Before we let you go, maybe we shouldn't be surprised by his production, but we talked about it on the last call, Brian, during the regular season, how some people just weren't taking into consideration getting Kucherov back on the ice and what a difference he can make and really how different the Lightning do look. Do you get the sense that in some ways has caught the Panthers off guard a little bit? And are you surprised at how well he's looked through two games?
I honestly can say I'm not surprised. I did about three or four radio shows before the series started, and everybody was asking, you know, same thing. Well, he hasn't played all year. I said, I wouldn't be surprised if he gets 2 or 3 points in the first game right off the bat. He's a fanatic. You guys know that. You watch him every day, and you're around practice, and we see what he's like. He's a fanatic. And I watched him really closely in practice the last 3 or 4 or 5 days right before the playoffs started. Those little trances that he goes into when he grabs 12 or 15 pucks and gets over in that right wing circle and he starts dancing around. Nobody else around him, you know, it's not part of the drills, and he starts shooting pucks in the net. It's what he does. He's one of the biggest, you can see it plain as day. He visualizes everything. He gets his head in the game before the game starts, days before, and, you know, before the series. I had very little doubt that he was going to have any issue. Of course, his timing's off a little bit, but that means it's only going to get better. Cooch, you know, what he's done is he's given Braden Point 30, 40, maybe 50% better opportunities than when Pointer was by himself all season. All due respect to Palat and whoever else was on that other wing all season. Pally can facilitate, he makes plays, he's good, he's solid, but he's not Kucherov, and he's not Point. Braden Point played all season like he was a running back in the NFL, skating the daylight, and he must have put 1,000 extra miles on with the puck without Kuch all year. With Kucherov now, he can give and go. Kuch doesn't operate at high speed all the time, far from it. He just finds his way, sifts his way into open areas, and then Braden darts in and out. But Braden had the puck all the time. So every team was getting closer and closer and shutting him down. In the offensive zone, Braden is so fast and so quick that he can elude the first one or two players. Then he goes all the way around the net and he skates back into trouble because he's so fast. There's only so much room in the offensive zone. And he could never find anybody to facilitate his give and goes good enough. He gives it to Cooch, then he darts around. Kucherov dances around in small spots, 8 or 10 feet wide, and in Point is gone from one side of the ice to the other, and they give and go. So his effectiveness for Braden Point, you can see the ease. Did you see the entries on the power play in this series so far? I mean, they walked in most of the time. That's because Kucherov, before that Point, during the season, they just know, well, Braden Point's going to have it. He has one pass option here. We'll take that away. Yeah, we'll run him out of room. Boom. They had trouble. With Cooch in the lineup, everything is different. And, of course, he makes great plays on the power play. There's no doubt about that. His shot was simply outstanding. Those two goals that he scored on the power play, absolutely terrific. And the pass to Braden Point for his power play goal, just typical Cooch. He was ready when the puck dropped, and it's onward and upward because he's got more stamina building up in him.
It's good stuff. Brian, enjoy the fireworks tonight. Should be a lot of fun with that many fans
you're
in the building.
You're bringing fireworks? You got rockets and everything?
I may get arrested if that happens, right?
I'm past you. I know. I mean, you're prepared for everything.
I am. I'm ready. I've got it ready to go. But enjoy the game tonight. Should be a lot of fun. We'll see you soon.
Thanks, Brian.
Thanks, guys.
All right. That's Brian Engblom joining us here on Power Lunch on Lightning Power Play. Hope you enjoyed that. And I thought some good hockey talk there, Dave. Anything stand out for you before we
start? Yeah, well, he is not ruling out the possibility of Luke Schenn replacing David Savard.
How about that,
huh? Bold statement.
That was a bold statement.
I would not have thought that would have come out of his mouth. I think Savard has fit in, but
does that tell?
I'm
us,
not
though?
Seeing things the same way as Brian does. Brian played the position. So, at the NHL level.
At a high level. He's
and he's watching he's watching things from a different perspective and a very informed perspective.
The tough thing about Savard is that, I mean, he basically has these playoffs to figure it out because he's not going to be back next year.
Yeah, and it's not like not knowing what to do. It's having almost the courage or the fortitude to go for it because you're fighting yourself. That's kind of what Brian was saying. You're fighting yourself that, if I stand my ground here, I'm going to get walked. And that's a hard thing to kind of work through your system
and you
come
know
out
what?
The other side and just have the unwavering confidence to know that this is the way the system works and this is what I need to do and it's going to be okay.
And I think, you know, I've read a lot of people who have talked about the amount that Tampa Bay had to give up to get Savard. And I keep telling people, when you're in a position to win now, if you feel like there's a guy you need to get, bring him in. You give up what you need to give up. I don't think you can look back and have buyer's remorse. I mean, sometimes these trades work out, like Coleman and Goodrow last year, and sometimes it may take a while for a guy like Savard to feel totally comfortable. And Dave, it's
and
two
that's
different
one
positions.
Part. And that's one part of playing defense. It does not take into account him penalty killing or him making plays to come out of his own zone. This is a specific part of it's an important part of the game. And Brian just talked about how he felt the neutral zone is the series. I mean, he has said that about other series too, but it is the part of the game where the other team has the puck. They are bringing it up the ice, and as the defenseman, what is your read? Where do you go? Do you back in? Do you stand up? There are advantages and disadvantages of both.
I think at the very least from that comment, whether you're somebody who is just casually watching the game or somebody who is an expert like Brian, it's fair to say with that comment, Savard has not played as well as they would have liked. And the fact that Schenn could be that option doesn't mean the coaches are considering it. I know Brian has been very high on Luke Schenn in his limited role and has performed it very well, probably better than the role the Lightning have for Savard. Understanding that may be apples to oranges, Dave, but in terms of what they're assigned to do, I think Schenn does it better right now for the Lightning than Savard does right now for what they want them to do.
Yeah.
And we'll see how that plays out, and let's hope it's a better game tonight. If the Lightning go up 3-0, I think it's fair to say the Panthers have some real problems, and I think that's why they're going to come out flying tonight. This should be a really good one. We'll start the festivities off at 5:30. We've got the pregame at 6. Dave and Phil have the call at 6:30. Then I'll have the last call with Chief after the game, and then in between you can listen to a replay of this show, amongst other things. And Dave, we just appreciate everybody listening because this is the best time of year. Great job, partner. We'll talk to you in a little bit.
All right. See you in a few hours.
Thanks to Steve Erstnick as well. Thanks to Brian Engblom. I am Greg Linnelli. It's game 3 tonight right here on Lightning Power Play.